Salvation needs to be understood in this sense, and he ties this into the Eucharist in a Catholic Catholic context, that God is for us whatever we need God to be at that time. God is for us whatever we need God to be at that time. And that is, in the words of Jan Sobrino, a piece of bread on the plate of a starving person. Mm-hmm. That is truly salvific. And it is for us all we need here and now on earth, not in some otherworldly heavenly realm that, again, has been caricatured in the tradition and in some sense is upheld literally in the tradition. And we want to do away with that because that is unhelpful. And it truly, according to Lynn White, has created much of the ecological crisis. It's all problematic, I guess I'm trying to say.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Free Radical Podcast. Today, I had the honor, the pleasure of meeting a dear friend, Christian scholar, theologian, and author, Robert Nicastro. Robert Nicastro, PhD, is a theologian, teacher, and writer whose research explores the convergence of religion, science, and artificial intelligence. His work focuses on how emerging technologies are reshaping human identity, planetary consciousness, and the future of religious thought. He is also the executive director of the Center for Christogenesis, where he leads efforts to advance an integrated vision of science and spirituality rooted in the thought of Teilhard de Chardin. His doctoral dissertation, The Future Soul Eve's Support, Metaphysics, Hyperphysics, and the Theology of Teilhard de Chardin, offers a reinterpretation of Teilhard's cosmic vision as a compelling metaphysical framework for addressing the complex challenges of the 21st century. Today's a special episode, since in a few days I'm officially launching my third book, Evolution in Divine Love, The Eternal Becoming of God, Soul, and Matter. So that will be the main theme we will explore in today with Robert, who is very close to the themes I'm touching up on my book, since he's very close companion and colleague of Ilya Delyu, who has been one of the main source of inspiration for the content of my forthcoming work. So today we have been exploring the main themes of my book, Love in Constant Evolution, and how the nature of an ever-evolving love makes for an ever-evolving divine, which changeless at the same time, but also undergoing its own ongoing expansion in his experience of divine love. How all of this makes for us as souls, giving us the possibility of embracing an endless prospect and potential, and in turn how the material energy, apparently inert, it's undergoing its own continuous evolution and expansion. So these are some of the main topics we have touched upon today, and you are welcome to join us in the conversation. This is the Free Radical Podcast, so to support it, please subscribe to the channel by clicking on the bell, and if you feel nourished, inspired by the conversation, like it, share it, drop on your comments, to continue this conversation ongoing, paying back by paying forward. So without further ado, dear brothers and sisters, this is Robert Nicastro. So Robert, thank you so much for joining us in our Free Radical Podcast. And first of all, congratulations on completing your recent PhD.
Thank you, Swami. It's really great to be here. I appreciate the invitation.
My pleasure. So if I'm not mistaken, how we came to know each other, still not in 3D yet. I met Ilya Delyu recently in 3D, and somehow talking about our relationship, Ilya has to come into the picture for sure. I had the honor of being invited by her, I think 2 years ago, to her podcast, Hunger for Wholeness. And then I had the pleasure of having her in my Free Radical Podcast. And then you all in the Center for Christogenesis invited me to give a lecture actually on a similar theme that we'll be touching up on today, evolution in divine love. And and here we are, continuing with the flow of collaboration. I really like the concept, for me at least, collaboration. Recently I was listening to a lecture, someone said, social creatures, one of our greatest adaptations is our ability to cooperate together.
Yes.
Right? And one teacher of mine said once, collaboration is the beginning of love. No, if love sounds like it too much of a big concept, okay, let's collaborate with one another. That's a good way to start with. So in that spirit, I like to ask you and my guests always, what brings you today to the table of conversation? Which contribution, which collaboration you expect to make to the world today through the conversation we're about to have?
Well, first of all, again, thank you for having me. This is a conversation that is very worthy of attention today. And as you said, cooperation, which has so much, in many ways, such a synonymous relationship with the larger arc of evolution in terms of how we understand love in the larger frame of the relationship between science and religion. Why is that important, and why do I think that's necessary to emphasize right at the door? Because many of our scientists today, our best scientists who are doing the best science, are saying that synergy, or the relationship between entities, is our greatest reality, that cooperation that allows union to exist, but then leads to greater differentiation or personalization, which is, I know, the heart of your previous work and certainly overlaps quite nicely with your newest work. So to contribute to that discussion is certainly something that I think is absolutely vital, because we're allowing, in a theological and a philosophical sense, the science to speak to us in all of our work. So we're creating this coherent framework that many are trying to do, but not many have done with success. And we only need to look at our society and our world to see quite clearly why these attempts have not been so successful yet.
Amen. Thanks so much for those words, Robert. More than welcome. So I was thinking that also, before we delve into our main topic of today, evolution and divine love, the other day, like just 2 days ago, when we are recording this, today's June 4th, we are recording 2 days ago, I had the pleasure of meeting Ilya Delio first time in my visit in Washington, D.C. And part of a conversation was also about Robert Nicastro. And she was sharing about how you also studied, went for the seminary for some time as well. I don't know, I was curious if you would like to share with me and our audience a few words about what brings you to where you are here today in connection to your studies, religious affinity, cultivation, scholarship, whatever you would like to share for a few minutes. Yeah.
Yes, thank you. And I know that you were raised in the Catholic tradition, is that correct?
I was, yeah. Actually, my mom wanted to be a nun when she was very young. So I had some interesting religious impressions and influence coming from her side, yeah.
Oh, okay. So yeah, there's, again, considerable resonance, even in terms of our background, which, as you know, is eminently important for helping understand where we are today, especially regarding our theological interests. So yes, as you said, I spent some time in the seminary, a Catholic seminary, and that was begun in 2011. And I was influenced by a diocesan priest. Never thought for a second that I would ever have interest in priesthood. I was very interested in theology and very interested in understanding what the experience of transcendence can do for us as a human race, but never really thought that I could serve in the capacity as a priest. Not because I didn't think I was worthy or anything like that. Certainly the idea of worthiness is a consideration, but I never really thought that I could express my integrity as a human person or as an intellectual in the confines of the Catholic Church. And ultimately, I'll say this quite candidly, that's one of the reasons why I left. I wanted to pursue a theological education, which I thought would allow me to be integral as an ordained minister. But given that the diocesan priesthood doesn't really cultivate the genius of the intellectual life along with the life of service, most especially because there's such a lack of priests, they can't send you away for it, nor can they devote sufficient time to allow you to do that academic work. I knew that if I were to be true to myself and actually do the work of the greater divine love, I would need to do so as a lay academic more than an ordained priest. So in 2016, I had left then and went in pursuit of this degree in theology and philosophy.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing your story. And I really appreciate your call to integrity and how to honor your call in the best possible way, in whatever shape that may take, and how to express your individuality. I'm all about that with my own idea of radical personalism, as you know, how to be all that we can be as individuals in service, of course, to divine love. Right. So yeah, we're really touched by your journey as well. So anyhow, in 3 days from the day this podcast will be published, I will be publishing my third book, which is Evolution in Divine Love. That will be the day of the official launching, 3 days after this conversation we are having. And of course, Ilia Delio was one of the main inspirations for the book. And I'm so honored that she also wrote such a very beautiful and generous and humbling endorsement for the work. But besides that, yeah, her work, I recall reading first time The Emergent Christ, and among other works that I read, Unbearable Wholeness of Being and The Not Yet God and so on, was a very interesting trigger for me to somehow rediscover, go back to my tradition, so to say, after reading her book, and rediscover how many of the things she was speaking about were actually spoken about in my own tradition in different terms, different words, but the principle of ever-evolvingness or deep evolution, as I like to call it, was very much present there. So, of course, now I'm about to publish my book on this theme, and I felt, okay, I want to have, if not Ilia, which I already invited her to my podcast a few years back, and I keep inviting different guests so far. So I think if it's not her, it has to be someone from her tribe, so to say, from her inner circle. So you were, of course, the very first person that came to mind. So again, thank you so much for accepting that invitation.
Oh, my honor.
And I'm thinking maybe, yeah, we can go through, you have gone through a little bit through the book. I've shared that with you in advance some material. So I was thinking maybe we can try to briefly touch upon some of the main sections. The book is divided into four parts, mostly speaking about the ever-evolvingness of love, of God, of the soul, and of matter, right? So maybe we can touch upon something. Let's see where the conversation takes us. Again, it's an ongoing, ever-evolving dialogue, so we don't know where the current will take us. But the first chapter of the book is called Love's Odyssey, the From Seed to Perpetual Becoming. So again, the main theme will be love is not a fixed quantity. It grows, it shapes, it evolves, it unfolds, it reveals. And on top of that, it makes God, the soul, and matter enter in its own dance of a perpetual unfolding. So to begin with the word love that comes to my mind, the word love is, of course, maybe arguably one of the most used words. And generally, with most used words, probably are the less understood many times. So many times we use the word love, but it's poorly defined in evolution in divine love. I try to offer what I could feel a more coherent and expansive definition of love, when love is not seen only as a feeling merely or as a possession, but as evolutionary force. So how do you see this this challenge of redefining love for our time?
Oh my gosh. Well, as you said, and this is very a Teilhardian perspective too, as I think you know, this whole notion of hearing love, just like the term faith, it has all of the, it's saturated with so many unhelpful connotations. So many of us walk around thinking that we're daily living in love and doing love. But in reality, if we're not actually initiating and allowing the growth and development of unity to occur on all levels, most particularly the level of consciousness, because we are, as we know, as Homo sapiens sapiens, the most sophisticated arrow or the sophisticated directing guides of the evolutionary story, that is of the wholeness of the whole, God, person, and world, or matter, spirit, divine nature, as you mentioned. So to put that idea of love as a unifying energy that undergirds and is itself rising in and through all life, front and center, or as the story that's driving evolution, to put that in this renewed framework in an age that is absolutely saturated with divisiveness and fragmentation. In fact, fragmentation has become the language of life, I would say. Mm-hmm. So to put that into this framework, as you have done, is really allowing us a new way to actually allow God to be God in our time. And that is really the essence of love, to allow the greatest potentiality of our life, that is God in us and in all things, to be truly the fullness of that life. So I would say that is certainly a great place to begin with a definition of love as a creative energy undergirding all things, and then putting that in a new framework that's so, at least on the surface, seems to be diametrically opposed to how we live, move, and have our being, at least in the 21st century, is absolutely vital for moving forward and giving us a future that's not only worth having, but worth living.
Thank you. I'm thinking about, of course, both you and Ilya, as well as Kayla Desjardins, were very in tune with technology and the dialogue, the engagement with technological developments at the time.
Right.
We are living in an age which is, technological developments are going faster and faster, and there are so many questions to ask about what to do with that, right? So, and I was thinking, I usually use that example in my lecture sometimes, like, everyone knows when we say that, okay, if you have a cell phone and you don't download the latest app, your phone basically becomes obsolete,
right?
It's outdated, so it's no longer working. So for me, it's an interesting idea to take advantage of, in the sense of talking about love as ever expanding.
Yes.
And something that requires and finds itself in a state of constant update to remain operative to the needs of the moment, to continue loving more, so to say. So I don't know if in your view, the idea of ever-expanding love help reframe even, I don't know, spiritual maturity? You know? Not love as a purity, but love as a capacity of deeper relationality. And
how
does it all make sense to this parallel that I'm making with the ever-unfoldingness of technology in our modern day? Yeah.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And as you do so well, you always know how to turn a phrase. It's not spiritual purity, it's spiritual maturity. I love that. I think that's marvelous. And I want to keep with the image and the reality of technology as our fastest evolver.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think this idea of love as a new framework, especially within the context of technology and artificial intelligence, which, by the way, there's probably nothing artificial about artificial intelligence.
Mm.
As I like to say, there's an artificial nature often to some persons, but not necessarily to the intelligence that's driving the means and the depth of expansive unity. But the image of love within this context, to get to the heart of the question now, gives us a new GPS, or a godly positioning system.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not necessarily a new image or a new concept to convey this reality. But when we plug into what science is telling us about the world, that everything is some kind of form of energy, and this energy has an endless depth, we begin to then ask the question, well, what do we do with this idea of a God who is love?
Mm-hmm.
How do we situate that within an evolutionary context, especially a God who is love, who guides this deepening development? Well, plugging into the best science of the day, the understanding that everything is energy, that love is energy, allows us to plug into God as a new guiding, organizing, and developing principle of life.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a new way to guide or direct our technologies, I think, if we're not thinking along, we don't have to be coming from the same principles or religious background, but I think we should be at least looking in a similar direction. And right now, without a technology that's guided by the ethical principles of love, I think we're all heading for probably either a dystopian state, which is very possible, even Teilhard believed that, or a utopian state in its best sense, that the ideals of love, truth, beauty, and goodness are actually lived to their fullest degree possible. Not a utopian sense in any illusory way, but a utopian sense in that, yes, we have this future that everything and everyone is living in peace and peaceability, and love is the new language and flavor of the day, and it's actually a reality, perhaps for the first time. To quote Teilhard, to recognize love in the fullest degree possible, at least in any context, is to discover fire again and to actually allow it to breathe new life into us and make us walk. So I really think that using love, as you name it so well, Swami, and putting it within the context of technology as a new GPS or godly positioning system could actually be the key to a new tomorrow.
Beautiful. Thank you. Yeah, I really appreciate your usage of the word energy because it resonates so much in our own tradition, ancient Vedic texts, that the word Sanskrit word Shakti, which basically means energy of potency, has been used to refer to different types of energy, but whether to love, to us as souls, to a spirit, to matter. I mean, everything is labeled under that department of energy.
Right. You
know? So it's a very, we can take the word for granted, but there's so much mystery and implications to unpack as you are doing with what does energy mean
right
now, today, because energy is energetic by nature, it's alive, it's in vibrance, right?
Yes.
And I love the famous, of course, arguably that's the most famous phrase from Taylor de Chardin that you quote, concluding the word fire.
Yeah.
And in our tradition, it's interesting because it is said that the very first word that was heard in the universe, long story short, was fire, actually. Tapas, fire. And of course, fire is a symbol for so much, but still, I couldn't avoid relating that to going back to fire in terms of tenderness, of light, of introspection, of entering to the fire, and love being the ultimate fire, so to say. Yeah.
It's beautiful. And it allows for one of the words that you use that I think would be important just to clarify for folks who might be listening and who might think that mystery is often a term that's used to explain away the inexplicable. And I find that very unhelpful because often, even in terms of science, scientists don't like the word mystery because it presumes a certain element of we'll never be able to get to the bottom of X, Y, or Z variables or conditions, which in a sense, that's very true. But science, again, the best of science and theology, the best of theology, never dispenses with mystery or uses it as an excuse to cloud the invisible. Rather, it serves to heighten that which is yet to be fully seen or made fully present to us, not to abolish it, not to disguise it, not to mask it, but to point, to use as a placeholder for a heightened sense of that which is not fully yet. And I think, again, if we're really using the best philosophy of love, both in science and religion, then we can truly see the world as fully and as completely as possible in any on any given day or at any one given time. So I just wanted to offer that clarification, and perhaps you agree. I don't know, but okay.
Yeah, of course, I totally do. I love to use the word mystery, but I also agree with you that sometimes that for some people may sound like whether spooky or evasive. Okay, you are playing the mystery card. And that spoils the whole deck, as Thomas Jayord will say.
And
we don't want to do that, but also we don't want to become overconfident in trying to measure reality—a reality that is in constant expansion, right? So,
right.
But yeah, I totally. If whether we use the word mystery or other, it's good to clarify what we are trying to talk about here. So yeah, in connection to love as mystery, given your clarification now, I like to think of love in its perpetual unfolding. I mentioned in the book that true love, in my opinion at least, has no opposite. In other words, if I truly love, there's true love, it cannot turn into hatred, so to say. It cannot be degraded into something other than what it already is, but instead it can only deepen and expand. So I don't know, I'd like to hear your thoughts on that, and maybe how does this view may challenge or in some cases support more traditional theological notions of love.
Yeah, well, let's stay right there with actually it doesn't only support a traditional notion of love, I think it renews it Especially if we're looking at the scripture in a comprehensive sense. And I'm talking about, just in this case, the Abrahamic religions, yeah. because there are certain themes that many biblical scholars pick up on. And one of the preeminent themes is, of course, God is love, as we already mentioned. Yeah. And when we talk about in a classical theological sense, again, you know, there are many different camps of classical theology, but I would say if we really line up the common thinking on love in many of these camps, we would probably reach the following conclusion, and that is, what is changeless about God is God is love, and God can do nothing else but love. Mm-hmm. And I want to really emphasize that point, because I know that's a driving theme in your book. And again, correct me if I get any of this incorrect, but it seemed to
You're
me
a very good student. No wonder you have a PhD.
thank you. And I love that, because I think that's really it. When we talk about what is when we're trying to bridge the old with the new, what is the ground diggers and the ground breakers? Mm. I think that we would say God is love, and God can do nothing else but God into existence, what is the essence of God, that would be to love. So what is unchanging is the fact that love is always, but that does not mean that love cannot deepen within each new context and circumstance. And that is where I think the novelty of love within an evolutionary arc, development, context, framework, whatever language you want to use to talk about the meta-narrative of our age, really makes a difference. So we have a God who cannot help but be God through deepening relationality with others. So love that has no opposite, in my estimation, is essentially saying that God and world are quantumly entangled, that there is room for distinction of identity, but not room for separateness, never room for separateness. And, mm-hmm. and identity, radical personalism, is always something that continues to mature with each moment of allowing the other to be truly who that other is meant to be. Again, always in and with a greater and deepening relationality. So I think that's where the novel principle of this perspective on love really helps bridge in a harmonious and wonderful way the classical conception of God is changeless. What about God is changeless is the key, though, right?
Yeah. Thank you for that. And I really appreciate, again, as you clarified what we were talking about when we were speaking about mystery, also about this important foundation of changelessness that I address in my book, and it's addressed in most classical theology. And what do we mean by that, and how that can be harmonized with the notion of perpetual novelty and ever new, fresh experience of love on God's part. So it's not that we are speaking about one and doing away with the other, nor vice versa either. No, so it's not so much like either or, but both and.
Absolutely. The non-dual approach, right?
Yeah. That's a very, in our tradition, there's a famous line that says Advaita Gyan Tattva, which basically means in Sanskrit, reality is non-dual consciousness. Now and then it starts to speak how that non-dual consciousness, that reality expresses itself in the form of so much diversity. Mm-hmm. But it begins with the foundation of unified wholeness, non-duality, and only on that foundation and that bedrock, diversity can exist in a way that is not conflicting, but even like an ornamenting each other.
Right.
And for me, it has such an important power nowadays, as you say before, in the world we are living today with division and fragmented consciousness has become kind of the norm and the language. Yeah. We need to create so much bridge and to show how we all share a common non-dual foundation, and only acknowledging that properly, all the existing diversity can create harmony and not further and further conflict. Yeah.
Absolutely. And Alfred North Whitehead, another wonderful philosopher whom you drew upon to make your contribution, talks about a harmony of contrast. The world, every person contributes to this harmony of contrast, which is always undergirded and emboldened by a wholeness. Mm. And this is I think part of our serious this is both in my opinion a diagnosis and a recommended therapy. That if the diagnosis is we don't acknowledge that we come from a whole and we contribute to the whole, the recommended therapy, as you're suggesting, I think, is to have eyes that can truly see, because only when we see with greater vision, mm-hmm. we actually live into the insights that are ours. Mm-hmm. And the greatest insight is that we are wholes within wholes.
Holarchy. Yeah, yeah, I love that term. I love that term. I owe that to Ilya, so thank you so much. And it was so beautiful. I was telling actually that to Ilya the other day that we met about the holarchy, and how when I heard holarchy, my mind went back to one famous mantra verse from our tradition, which says Om Purnamada Purnamidam, etc., which is the word Purnam many times, and Purnam means whole or complete. So it says God is complete, the world is complete, this is complete, that is complete. So for me, I was like, oh, holons, a holarchy, you know? That's the holarchy mantra in our tradition. But I didn't have the word holarchy to refer to that. So yeah, such a beautiful idea. And I totally agree with that. Thank you. I could continue talking with you on this particular first chapter forever, because by definition, we are talking about something that has no end. But I like maybe to move to the second chapter of the book, which is, of course, totally related, which is God. And the title is Can God Be Updated? And actually, I recall Ilya using that expression also, updating God. Again, in modern term, we all know what we speak about when we say updating the right. latest version, the latest app, and so on. And in that chapter, again, I'm talking about divine changelessness, how that is not opposed to divine novelty or newness, how the sweet absolute, as I like to sometimes refer to the divine, evolves, never regresses. So there in one part, I suggest that in order to know God, we probably, most of us at least, first need to be willing to unknow God, mm-hmm. to let go of all the frameworks, especially if we are talking about a God in constant state of update, which right. may require a constant state of unknowing to get to know the newer version, so to say. Right. So I wonder, I don't know, how does this kind of creative unknowing, if you will, shown up in your own spiritual practice or in your academic work, in your life?
Yeah, it's a sense of the renewed apophatic tradition that there's you can't pin down an ultimate source. You can't pin down the source of light. Ramon Panikkar, the great Spanish mystic, recalls that the etymology of God is first a Sanskrit word. And this notion of this vast pervasiveness of life can't be contained in boxes, and it can't be pinned down. One can't draw a picture of it, but one can have a deep experience of something that is both within themselves and more than themselves. And I'm using that language very carefully, because the classical traditional stance would be to say that God is within and beyond. Well, that conjures up some unnecessary hierarchical thinking that just isn't consonant with the worldview given to us by contemporary science. But within and ahead points to a future that is constantly being co-created by world and its divine source.
The God ahead, as Ilya will say, instead of the Godhead, right?
Yes,
the really God. I like that expression, yeah.
That's right. And I also like Alfred North Whitehead, who compliments Ilya, and again, what you're doing so well, that if we're going to really take God seriously and have an experience of God that's worth having, and what I mean by that, I don't want to minimize different experiences of God. I'm not saying that all, but if we want to have a relationship or an experience with God that's fully enriching to us, I think we have to, here's the Alfred North Whitehead quote, we have to talk about a God who's less alpha and more omega, less behind and more ahead. So, all by way of saying, that's an experience of God that can help arm us with a capacity for knowing newly the transcendent in each new time, place, and circumstance. Now, to your question, when we haven't been fed on a steady diet of that thinking, how then do we engage the process of unknowing or unlearning in order to experience that new sense of transcendence to the fullest degree possible? I don't have any ready answers, but I can say that in my own thinking and work, it's really to just recognize that thinking and experience itself is a process. I mean, David Bohm, the great physicist philosopher of the 20th century, who is responsible, by the way, for those who don't know, for that term, not responsible for the term, but responsible for giving rise to the term holon and holarchy, giving his system, made it clear that we still think in a very Newtonian-like state. So we think in static terms, and we treat knowledge as a result as an accumulation of unchanging facts. Therefore, how much more do we do so with God? Well, when we understand thought and facts as provisional, or that we're always approximating a truth within a larger capital R reality, then we can begin to think of experiences of the transcendent in the same way. So I think starting with that hermeneutic or way of experiencing and thinking and knowing the world can help us begin to let go of things that we thought we might know with certitude, those ironclad realizations, and become more open to experiencing and thinking about that which undergirds those provisional truths newly and with a greater appreciation. So that would be more of a recommendation for approaching the process of unlearning, but it's certainly much more difficult in practice than it is in theory. But then again, as we know, in an interconnected world, there's no separation between theory and practice.
There you have it. Yeah, thank you. I was actually thinking about that. In our tradition, we have this notion of sambandha that I also referred to in the book. We have something called sambandha vidya prayojan that roughly could be translated as theory, practice, and result.
Yeah.
But also we emphasize how one affects the other. So sambandha will be like the conceptual orientation you have to life, to God, to you. So according to what you have as that sambandha, as that orientation, that will affect how you experience your practice, your life, and that will bear a particular fruit. So it's all interconnected. So it's so crucial to go to that, to have the proper conceptual orientation to begin with, to warrant the experience that we actually need to be having.
Yes.
You mentioned so many interesting things. And again, many things that we were talking with Ilya the other day, because I couldn't avoid asking her, so what's your next book about? And she was telling me, actually, I'm writing two. And one of them very much influenced, at least one, probably two, but at least one, she mentioned one, influenced by Raymond Panikkar as well.
Yeah.
So you referred to him and his notion that the word for God came from the Sanskrit, which actually the word is Deva. And it's very interesting because Deva comes from the root Sanskrit div, which translates as light and as an expansive and so on, but also translates as play, interesting, to play. Mm-hmm. So interestingly, the word for God somehow is he, she, them, whatever, however, who plays.
Yes. No?
So it indicates some playful, dynamic, spontaneous movement. Not like a fixed, predictable thing, but something that improvisation, if you want to use that word. In fact, in our tradition, the actions of God are generally described as lila, and lila is translated as divine play. Hmm. So generally, God is conceived as engaged in play, in an absorbing play, right? Like very spontaneous, very creative, which is, any play has its own rules, and I'm not saying God's play has no rules, but when God plays, he plays really well and really hard, so maybe new rules are also created on the way. And I also appreciate what you mentioned about God being, for many, static, and the opposite of static will be ecstatic, and the word ecstasy actually means out of the norm, right? So if we want to enter the realm of ecstatic, ever-evolving, unfolding, we have to go out of the norm of how we usually think of God, think of everything probably. So that's it.
Right.
Challenging deconstruction, but a necessary one.
Oh, absolutely. And to recognize within that, that God also has ecstasy within God's self. Mm-hmm. And that I think, again, this is part and parcel of love in a, in an integral sense between God or between and among God, person and world, that that love also takes God, allows God to stand outside of oneself. Or maybe I actually, you know, allows is too weak a term. Love impels God to stand outside of God's self. It's not just a matter of, okay, I want to do this, but, and you know, this is also something that I think is absolutely vital. And I think this also appears in chapter two. So it's right on par, and I'll only spend a minute on it if you want, but I think it's very important that the idea of God changing, not necessarily being a lack within the divine nature, but certainly a desire, a deeply dynamic desire to become more, to actualize an entirely new set of potentialities that weren't there as foregone conclusions in the beginning, but that authentically arise because of risk in the evolutionary process, surprise in the way in which relationships actually work. I mean, that's what true freedom is all about. And the open-endedness of a future that is not predetermined. And I think this also gets to the heart of what you're saying about true love really, again, I want to use that word allows, but it's not quite strong enough to capture the reality of what we're talking about. True love really impels us to will the good of the other, or to will a future for the other. Mm-hmm. When often we think of love in very static, unchanging terms, or we only love what a person truly is at any one given time, even if it's with all the faults, the failings, the joys, and the beauty, that's fine and that's wonderful. But when we truly love, we're truly loving that person into what he or she can become. Mm-hmm. So we're unleashing the potentiality that exists within both relationships that are a part of one larger arc of relationship. Mm. So just wanted to make another comment about that, because it's so important, I think, and it helps connect everything that we've discussed up until this moment.
Thank you. Thank you for throwing that thread, that rope for us to hold on and get a further glimpse of what you are talking. Yeah. I'm totally in with what you are mentioning. And thank you so much for being such a good reader, are reminding myself of my own work. It's good. I'm rereading it in terms of proofreading and checking details, but not from a place of a reader. So it's always healthy to receive that feedback as well. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So moving to the third part of the book, again, I'm doing relatively quick, because there is a lot to go there. But in the third chapter of the book, I turn from God, love as ever evolving, God as ever evolving, then speaking about us as the soul, as spirit, as Atman, if we will call it in our tradition. Yeah. And as you were just saying, not only who we are, but all that we can be. What's the soul? The name of the chapter is Mapping the Soul's Unbroken Potential. Hmm. And I basically begin that chapter saying, actually, in our tradition, at least, the soul can only be defined in terms of its potential.
Yeah.
Like the very terms that we use in Sanskrit for speaking about who we are, it's in terms of all that we can be. Yeah. So it's not that it's a separate thing, but we are, as I like to say, a unit of potential, right? So that makes an invitation for a very generous, as you said, outlook to other people. I'm not seeing you for who you were. Sometimes we don't even see each other for who we are, but right. Oh, Robert, you did this 20 years ago. I know who you are and I put you in that box forever, right? No, not very generous. And even if I judge you or see you for who you are now, it still is not the full picture, because you are all that you can become. So, right. So, and that's, I will argue, how God is looking at us, so to say. So we are being seen with that generosity and how the saints and the enlightened beings look at everyone, we should try to return the gaze in those right. same terms, in how we relate to the whole of reality.
Yes.
I don't know if you have any thoughts about us as units of potential. You already shared some, but I want more.
Yeah, no, this is a conversation, as you mentioned, we can't fully exhaust by any means. Yeah. Right? It's all about potential and growth and expansion. So absolutely. The idea of the soul as a unit of potential too. Again, if we're going to really be serious about bridging the classical philosophical stances with the new, we can certainly argue with Plato that we're creating a new world soul by understanding each soul as a unit of potentiality rather than actuality. And again, we're taking in Aristotle, Plato, and a bunch of others here too. But when we're talking about a renewed world soul, we're specifically speaking about Plato's notion. So we're still renewing or expanding or deepening that which is very much given to us in tradition, philosophical tradition. And the soul, as John Cobb, a wonderful process theologian, talked about the soul as a collection of all our experiences. And with it, that, when we talk about a collection, again, that sometimes is language that conjures up static language, but a collection of all of our experiences in a situation or a worldview that recognizes that the potentiality of experience is endless can be nothing but dynamic. Mm-hmm. And what I love about this too is nothing is lost with a collection or an assimilated body of experiences that are taken up into something new, because you need the fodder or the previous experience in order to recognize something that's entirely and irreducibly novel in the present moment. Mm-hmm. And I guess a good example of that would be previous loves in one life. When you had the experience of say the love of a mother and father in one context, that is an experience, as we mentioned, but it's a particular type of an experience of a particular love. Mm-hmm. A love that is imprinted, therefore preserved and hopefully not forgotten, but certainly even if it is forgotten in an intellectual sense, it's still very much indelibly part of you, because it's an experience that made you who you are then. But now in a new circumstance or context of love, a wife, a partner, a friend, etc., there's a new experience that's of love that's different from a mother or a father. And at the same time, it's recognizably love, because there's something about the selfless givenness that's still true and good in this context, even though the selfless givenness might be expressed a little differently or have a different hue or shade to it. But it is novel and it is a new context. And it too is forever assimilated or preserved into a larger collection or body of experience that is a unique unit that's now a part of the soul, or that's now given rise or expanding the soul. So I think that's very important, and that's definitely giving a nod to Plato that we need something much larger than just the material. But we also need something that's much larger than the material that can resonate with our lived experiences of love and reality today. A reality that is evolutionary, a reality that is dynamic, a reality that has the promise of tomorrow, but never a guarantee of tomorrow. And this is where the potentiality of God also comes in, because a God who is part of what the future can become is a God who then shares love by allowing, there's that word again, allowing, it just rolled my tongue. I don't want to say allowing.
No problem. We already made the warning and the clarification that we actually do not mean what we generally understand allowing.
We don't, so I'll stop redacting that point. but a God who is not yet, a God who is in the future, a future that's predetermined, a future that's not yet, is a God who is calling out for greater self-expression, greater self-realization, and through our love. So I guess all by way of saying, and this is to turn a phrase of Friedrich Nietzsche, who once said, God is dead. And again, spoiler, this also appears in the book in some context, but it's very important. God is dead is speaking about a God who is a God that's no longer resonant with experiences of an evolutionary world, but a God who is not dead, but not yet fully alive or fully born. Is a God who is truly love in the context of a world of quantum physics, systems thinking, and a world that's still coming to be. And that is a love that truly respects the freedom of the other and allows the other to become other. And that is a very powerful sense of soulfulness and identity. I hope I'm responding to your question.
You are responding, and you are creating new questions with your answer, which is what every genuine answer must create. So thank you. Yeah, I was just thinking about this definition of God in the Bible, where he generally is translated as I am who I am. But from what I've heard from scholars is that he's actually saying, I will be what I will be, or something like I will become what I will become. So this is spoken in a future tense, and he's speaking in terms of potential. So yeah, for me, that's basically the only God that could make sense, basically. And I love that you quoted Nietzsche. And of course, unfortunately, he's only known by saying God is dead. But interestingly, in other sections, he, apart from any other interesting thing he said, he will say also, I will only believe if God will come to me as a dancer, I will immediately surrender to him.
Yeah.
So for me, that also is the other part of the equation. Okay. God is dead, and by God he means something in particular, but a God that is a dancer, to imply, again, movement, dynamism, unfolding. That God makes sense. No? So,
yeah.
And as I always say, I talk with people that tell me, I do not believe in God. And when I ask them, so what's that God that you don't believe in? And they gave their list of qualities. I'm like, I don't believe in God, in that God either. Right. So in one sense, we are on the same page. You consider yourself atheist, I'm a theist, but we fully agree that's an impossible God, basically. Right. In my chapter also, Robert, at one point, and somehow this is connected, I speak about how if we live our life from this dynamic perspective in relation to the divine, which for me, of course, saying the divine doesn't exclude everything else, so it's a very integrative vision. And if we, in our tradition, we'll say bhakti, which is devotion or loving devotion of God, if we are living our life sincerely trying to imbibe those principles and values, technically speaking, we are already saved.
Yeah.
I mean, we are already doing what we will like to do for eternity. That's how I like to think it. If we are already living your life in a way that you feel, I could be doing this forever, that's basically you are already inhabiting eternity, right? In that sense, you are saved. You are living a life that is sustainable in eternity. Yes. And again, hopefully nobody thinks I'm arrogant by saying, I'm already saved. It's not my own. There's grace there and there are so many things. But for me, my main question here is, if we were to agree on this idea, okay, I'm already saved, then the real question was not even what I'm saved from, but what I'm saved for.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
So, and I cannot avoid thinking maybe there's no connection here, you tell me. Does Taylor's vision of Omega somehow relate to this kind of perspective?
Yes, but I want to, before I respond directly to Omega, I just want to say that scripture scholars would certainly agree with you. So again, this is not something that's completely out of left field or heretical in any kind of.
I'm supported. I'm not ready for the cross yet. Okay.
No. And this is now that's not to say that you're not giving a wonderfully novel contribution too, because you are. But there's a foundation here that's very important that I always want to emphasize, because I think it helps those who might be more fearful of this sense know that there's really nothing to fear. If anything, this arms us with the capacity for new life, and it allows us to live more fully today and tomorrow. So the great scripture scholar, Eugene Leverdier, in his book, Dining in the Kingdom of God, it's a very short exegetical treatise, but it's interlaced with many good anecdotes, I think, to give more experiential context to a more academic work, if you think it's academic. Not everybody might, but some do. At any rate, he says in this book that salvation needs to be understood in this sense, and he ties this into the Eucharist in a Catholic Catholic context, that God is for us whatever we need God to be at that time. God is for us whatever we need God to be at that time. And that is, in the words of Jan Sobrino, a piece of bread on the plate of a starving person. Mm-hmm. That is truly salvific. And it is for us all we need here and now on earth, not in otherworldly heavenly realm that, again, has been caricatured in the tradition and in some sense is upheld literally in the tradition. And we want to do away with that because that is unhelpful. And it truly, according to Lynn White, has created much of the ecological crisis.
Yeah.
So it's all problematic, I guess I'm trying to say. But there is support there, scripturally and otherwise, for saying that salvation is very much a this worldly reality. And Teilhard's, to your question about Teilhard's principle of Omega, that all we need for bringing about the reign of God is here and now, would certainly support it. And I think that's something about Teilhard's principle of Omega that's often misunderstood. It's often seen, even among some scholars, as a reality that is only not yet. But in order for Omega to be truly, really, and fully God, it also has to be here right now in the midst of us. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we would have no reason or no logical explanation for why the evolutionary process seems to preserve and assimilate all that has gone before. We would have nothing, no principle or no name for what accounts for that preservation in the evolutionary process. Teilhard, a good paleontologist with a good biological lens, would name that principle of centricity or unity Omega. And we would argue that if we're following that principle of unification within the evolutionary process as human persons, we're already living the salvific reality right now because we're doing what the process has showed us is best up until this point. Mm. And what love as an energy has led it to do up until this point, unify or suffer with, be truly compassionate for, not disregard otherness or one who seems unlike us or not minded in the same way as we are in terms of our thinking or holds onto our most cherished beliefs. So that I think he would hold that sense of salvation in that context.
Well, happy to know that coming from you, who is a very close person to his heart, I'm sure. And since we invoke one term from Teilhard, which is Omega, I would like to touch upon one more before we turn to the final chapter of the book on matter, which is the concept of noosphere. That's how you pronounce it?
Yeah, and the noosphere or nuosphere, yes.
Noosphere, okay. So in your own research, have you found resonances between this concept and the idea that, again, each soul is adding something never seen before to the divine relationship?
Yeah, I would. And I would also say that Carl Jung's principle of individuation is also part and parcel of this novelty. So the noosphere today, just to, in 60 seconds or less, because I want to get to make sure we get to chapter 5, would be most prominently actualized or lived through this relationship right now, through technology or a larger frame of connectedness that we can't just do as human persons one-on-one, or we can't do best as human persons one-on-one. The newest fear is creating a new global mind through which we can bring forth new instantiations, examples, or aliveness of love. So how do we become truly personalized through technology is where the real creativity as human person comes in. How do we, for instance, use technology to identify moments of poverty in areas of the world that we wouldn't normally identify, and then use technology as an extension of ourselves to give of ourselves to that poverty. Now, this is very interesting because the Christian scriptures tell us that poverty will always be among us. And in the next breath, it makes clear that doesn't mean we should, I'm paraphrasing, that doesn't mean we shouldn't create new innovative means to try to eradicate it in each new age, because it's always going to take new form. So we have to do our best to at least make the conditions impossible, even if we know it will never completely be eradicated. So yeah, that's the newest fear as an eminently human means to become more fully human by helping others who are struggling to be human in the first place is an important, novel, and absolutely vital way to create conditions of love where love seems impossible. And so, yes, I do see that in Teilhard, and I definitely want to see this happen, of course.
Yeah. Thank you. So we'll go to the fourth chapter of my book, which is on material energy. Now, first chapter, love ever-evolving. Second chapter, God as ever-evolving. Third chapter, the soul, the self as ever-evolving in potential. And then we reach matter, which sometimes matter may be seen or labeled at some people as inert, as dead weight. But actually, at least in my presentation, and I know this is aligned also so much with your presentation, matter is more seen as a type of divine current with conscious background and conscious presence and a sacred participant in love's evolution. As we said before, Shakti, an energy, a potency with potency, with aliveness and vibrancy, a living force, basically, not an inert thing. So, and I think Taylor, and I think I quote him in my book, this particular idea, he's mentioning that matter is spirit in slow motion or something to that effect.
Yeah, matter is spirit moving slowly enough to be seen.
Thank you so much.
Beautiful. It's beautiful.
So, do you think theology is finally catching up with this view?
No.
Let's cry together for a moment. There is time for grieving and mourning, no problem.
Yes, and it is a great lament, unfortunately. And let me just say, I'm sorry for a minute. I think I mentioned five or so sentences ago that we were moving. Fine. Okay, you know what I meant. I
create more expectation in the reader. There will be an extra chapter there.
Yeah, I'm sorry. So you caught me. Okay.
It's fine.
I misspoke. But no, unfortunately, theology has a long way to go for updating its God, and I think part of the problem is it's very easy for theology to become a discipline unto itself rather than a true vocation of exploration, and that's something that is very sad. But it doesn't mean that there's not immense potential for change to happen. We really have to believe that we ourselves can change. There's a great Jesuit theologian, Greg Boyle, who has founded one of the largest gang intervention centers in Los Angeles, Homeboy Industries. And a vital theme in his work is systems of thought change when people change. And people change when they believe that they're cherished. And I think many theologians are coming from a place of not necessarily cherishing. And I know this, I don't mean this to be a judgment. I certainly don't speak for everybody. I get a sense that many theologians are not coming from a place of being renewed by experiential cherishness or an experiential sense of the divine. That doesn't mean it doesn't, that doesn't mean it can happen, doesn't mean it doesn't happen. It just means that often in the way the thinking is, it's coming from old answers rather than new questions. And true experiences of the transcendent are always going to impel us into a freedom of creativity. And therefore, new structures of relating, new structures of thinking about God. A God that's not an idea or a concept, but that a God that's truly a relationship. Again, to be clear, I'm not saying that theologians don't have experiences of God. I'm just saying that I would hope that any experience of being truly cherished would lead to a renewed openness of mm-hmm. theological precepts. Because you can't have a relationship with a theological proposition, but you can always use theological precepts to point you to a renewed sense of relationship. Mm-hmm. So the two, while not mutually exclusive, can certainly be mutually reinforcive if the freedom for that dynamic flow mm-hmm. that exists in the first place. So theology, I have nothing but hope. I have nothing but hope.
Beautiful. And I really appreciate what you mentioned about the need for having this proper sense of cherishedness or whatever word you use. And somehow it ties with, of course, I'm about to publish my third book in a few days, but I've already almost finished writing a fourth one. And that one is on unconditional love and the fact that of knowing ourselves to be cherished by the divine, so to say, right? And how that can really change the picture of reality, you know, that to know that we are cherished in ourselves, that how that can, again, conceptual orientation can give a whole complete different picture of reality. So yeah, I appreciate that you mentioned that, and somehow it gives more a flow of relationality between one book that I write and the other, because for me they are also like natural overflowings of my previous reflection. They have to be related somehow.
Yes. So. And let me just say this, Swami, too, because this is a point I mentioned in the beginning, but I just want to make sure as we come full circle that it's clear, at least from me. And this ties back into what I was saying before about theology being mostly desiccated. And it comes down to a philosophy that undergirds theology. And that's what you're creating, a new philosophy by which we can think newly for theology. Mm. What is this philosophy of love, and how does it give new import for theology today? And that's what I think also handicaps our theological thinking in the here and now. It's the philosophy, an outmoded philosophy, that's not allowing theology to emerge in new ways or allowing new experiences of God. So that unlearning process. So I just wanted to clarify, because I think that's important too. It's we're not just doing theology; we're doing theology, philosophy, and science in new ways.
Thank you. Since you mentioned now theology, science, philosophy, of course, for me, of course, also, and I'm sure for you even more, probably there's this point where we feel science and scripture, if you will, need to meet. Need to have a long conversation with each other, not to flatten one another, but to help reality shine through both lenses, as you say, complementary. So yes. What is, on a personal level, what is your hope in this connection for the evolving relationship between theology, philosophy as well, and science? You already say that there is hope. Now I'm asking you, what is your hope?
well, my hope is if we really believe, and I do, and I think many of our religious traditions would agree, that God is first an experience both within us and more than us. And the experience to which we give that name is love. I think if we use that as our primordial lens by which we interpret scripture and by which we understand the presence of activity of God in an evolutionary world, that could be something that will break open the gates of the future. And again, what do we mean by love? We mean love as an energy, a fundamental energy of creativity. Mm-hmm. And what's so important is I think that is the primary metaphor. Love is the primary metaphor of God in at least the Hebrew and Christian scriptures, that the minute, and it speaks to the heart of a covenant, a covenantal relationship. The minute God enters into a covenant, there are certain things that God cannot do anymore, and there are certain things that God needs to do. and what limits, if we're talking about nuanced omniscience, right? This is also a term that appears in your wonderful book. The nuanced omniscience comes in because of a covenantal relationship. The minute I commit myself to you as a friend, there are certain things that I can't do if it doesn't will the good of your well-being. And that's, I think, again, what the heart of the unification process of evolution is all about. And that's and driven by the energy of love and what theology, scripture, and science can learn from if they're all going to enter into a greater collaborative relationship. And a word we began this conversation with was collaboration, and I chimed in with the word synergy. Now, there's a scientist, Francis Hallahan, who is willing to acknowledge synergy as a great synonym for a Teilhardian concept of love. Union differentiates, that Teilhard would say. There's, and synergy would say something similar, that it, if we look at the evolutionary process very carefully and intellectually honestly, we identify patterns of arrangement coming together, but not dissolving their individuality, actually heightening it, which is the essence of love, willing the full potentiality of the other. And I think that that's another way into that collaboration. Sometimes using synonyms that can help capture the openness of people in different disciplines who might be suspect of language that's not always helpful. Now, I love the word love, and I continue to uphold love. But until this new consciousness of what we mean by love, you and I and others in this context, becomes more pervasive in culture and society, it's I think can be helpful to capture it by other synonyms.
Yeah. Yeah, that reminds me, Father Richard Rohr, a common friend of us, probably. Yeah. Yes. He will say that we have misused so much the word God. He will refer to God in this case. Probably we need to put the word in a closet for 50 years, stop using it, and then take it back and rediscover it properly. So since God is love, the same way, love maybe not need to put to rest absolutely, but somehow at least understand that probably we are speaking about something more than what we usually refer. So before concluding this section of the depths of matter, Teilhard speaks about has this expression, the divine milieu.
Yes.
In relation to matter, to this world as a stage, so to say. And of course, many times in religious life, matter is dismissed or something to be transcended, and spiritual life becomes like some sort of evacuation plan into the afterlife. Let's leave this place as soon as possible and reach the otherworldly place. But I argue in my book, and you as well, I'm sure that matter is permeated by God's presence and divine emotion, that we live in a relational cosmos where God feels and evolves through the material, with the material, in the material. So just to conclude this section, a few thoughts if you could share with us, how can we reclaim this sacred view of embodiment that I feel is so needed in the times we are living?
Yeah, that is an excellent question and a difficult one. I think you already have your finger on the pulse of the problem, that we actually have to believe that matter is more than just matter. On the one hand, there is nothing but matter, especially when we understand that matter and energy are interconvertible in a post-Einsteinian cosmological context. And on the other hand, matter takes us beyond what we are. As I like to say, how do I want to say, there's so much here. How do we?
Sorry to bring that just at the end.
No. It's an important question. And I think it deserves some very it's a timely question too.
Yeah.
Because even in science, we tend to manipulate matter rather than treat it as something absolutely sacred. How do we reclaim it? Well, I think we have to understand that there's a vitality within all things, an unrepeatable uniqueness that needs to touch us at our core, so then we can begin to see that every element of existence shares with us a life that's absolutely impactful, that's always in the sense of enabling us and companioning us to seek out more. And that's also helping us to be open to uncreating different ideas and inventions that might not always be helpful to our full flourishing. And that's within philosophy, that's within science, that's within theology, that's within every arena. I guess what I'm saying is I want to return us to the issue of philosophy. So if we don't have a good philosophy of materiality, and in many ways, this was also what Teilhard was trying to create in his own time, given that he was comprehensively grasping all of the new insights of the new science in the early 20th century and all the way up until his death in 1955, there's something about renewing the face of the material that helps us see in the material our own sense of identity. And if we're not open to the insights of science that give us a new philosophy by which we understand that face behind all faces, we'll say God here in a theological context, we're going to continue to obliterate the material rather than actually amplifying that which could lead us to a deepening sense of who we are and what's guiding us and divinizing us in the first place. I don't really know any practical ways except to say that we do need a new framework. Otherwise, we're going to have more than just an ecological crisis, I'm afraid. But one nuance I want to throw into this, because I think we often, when we're talking about matter as human persons, we often confuse materiality with body. And I like to identify or point to the fundamental difference by using technology as an example. With technology, which if we read any of Ilya's work, she would certainly argue is the new form of embodiment in the 21st century and beyond. We can live probably without our bodies, but we can never live without materiality. So materiality takes many different forms. It's not always recognizably how we see and experience ourselves. I think that's a reductionist view of materiality. So a new form of embodiment or a renewed sense of what materiality is could actually be discovered through our technologically mediated relationships. So that could be a way into renewing a sense of embodiment by understanding how we're able to communicate now, see each other, listen to each other, maybe even better than we normally would in person. And then take that, harness that energy for understanding how we relate newly and use it within our science labs, use it within our theological musings and speculations, and use it to create a new philosophy that doesn't just reduce materiality to some classical understandings or just focus on the body as you and I are here and now, but on what we can become in and through our technologically mediated relationships. One more sentence on this, just to make sure it's clear. Technology is the name of the game, I think, going forward. If we don't begin to understand how we're relating to one another in and through technology, we're going to have a very difficult time finding new means for appreciating not only who we are as human persons, but how we relate to the planet. So embodiment, through technology should be the genesis for creating a new philosophy God, understanding God, person, and world. That's certainly my sense of things, understanding Teilhard's noosphere. It's not the only way, but I think it is. It's a, certainly a good way.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Robert. Can I beg you 2 more minutes before we conclude?
Yeah, absolutely.
I like to conclude some of my episodes by sharing some short questions to my guests, which invite for also short answers. So it's an exercise in conciseness as well.
I might have trouble here, but go ahead.
I may have trouble equally because I'm not good for conciseness either. But anyhow, we'll try. So I will ask you anyhow some 10 questions, short ones, inviting for short answers, all related to the topic we have been sharing. So
okay.
Fasten your seatbelt, Robert. Ready?
I'm
so
ready.
Number one will be, which is one theological dogma that should evolve, in your opinion?
Oh, one theological dogma that should evolve. I would say immutability.
Okay. Very good. Very concise. One word. Great. Which is that Taylor quote that you would tattoo on your soul? Not on your body. No problem.
Oh, yeah. Oh, one Taylor quote that would, I do love that, the one that matter is spirit moving slowly enough to be seen. I think that pretty much captures the heart of his cosmic vision.
Great. Number three, in your opinion, of course, which is the most misunderstood part of Taylor Desjardins' theology presentation?
Oh, the Omega point, hands down.
Okay. What question would Taylor be asking now that he couldn't have asked in his lifetime?
Oh, excellent. Excellent question.
And on top of that, I'm asking for conciseness in the reply. I'm so sorry.
You're really challenging me, which is great. I'm always looking for new challenges. Oh, I think he would be asking, how do we get out of not creating new dualisms? And I think that technology, because he was so much about technology leading us into a new evolutionary reality, that posthumanism and transhumanism movements today, by their very nature, are creating new dualisms by trying not to be dualistic. So I think that would be one of his principal focal points for sure.
Great. Thank you. And next one, if you had to describe your work in one symbol, what would it be?
One symbol.
Let's get Jungian for a moment and embrace the archetypal and symbolic.
Yeah, I would probably certainly resonate with you and say love as fire. The idea of fire being that symbol that is both has the tendency to give life but take it away, and it's all a matter of how we sort of accelerate or fan the flames of its potential.
Beautiful, poetic, beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah. Which is the most surprising truth that evolution has taught you?
That evolution has taught me that we construct the future.
If matter had a voice, what will it say?
Help.
Yes. Will you say that salvation is a place, a process, or a presence, or all of that, or some of them, or neither of them?
A place, a process, or a, what was the last one?
Presence.
Oh, a presence. Well, I would say that process is a word, a synonym for relationship. So I would say it's a presence.
Yeah.
And a relationship is necessarily a process. So it's relationality is a process and a presence. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. And all that maybe could be taken even as a place. As
right.
Where I'm residing now, state of consciousness. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, 2 more and we are done. What is one thing that God is still learning?
I would say that experience. So this is very interesting, and I just give a word of explanation. Experience and consciousness for Whitehead and Teilhard respectively sort of go hand in hand, and that is the reality by which God learns, through experience. I would say experience is something that's constantly is an unfathomable wellspring of potential and therefore comes with a lot of pearls of truth.
And since somehow this conversation has been revolving about around my forthcoming book, Evolution in Divine Love, what does the term Evolution in Divine Love mean to you? Besides my book, the expression, Evolution in Divine Love, what is telling to you?
Well, two things. First of all, another thing that God is learning is how to love perfectly. I think if I were to put one sentence to that, what is God constantly learning? It's how to love perfectly. So that to me,
the whole podcast to speak about what's perfect, right? Not as a fixed maximum, probably, but as ever new attainment of further reach and heights. Anyhow, sorry.
Absolutely. It goes on and on ad infinitum. Absolutely. Evolution in divine love. What does that mean to me? I think it expresses a relationship of entanglement among God, person, and world. So it's an inseparable relationship that constitute three dimensions of one reality, God, person, and world being those dimensions that constitute that one reality. And love is the matrix by which that reality continues to grow.
Amen. Thank you so much, Robert. You did pretty well with our back and forth. Great.
Oh, I'm great. Happy. Thank you so much.
So before we wrap up, any final words, conclusions, some reflection, whatever you feel, if there is something that you feel is needed to share for feeling yourself complete in today's conversation?
I would definitely want to tell your listeners, buy this book. It's absolutely wonderful. And I don't just say that because you're a good friend and a wonderful human being. I say that because this is truly a contribution that I think has the potential to make a considerable difference in the theological world, both in the academy and in the vernacular. So please take it seriously and use it as a way to help shape new relationships and give us a sustaining and thriving reality.
Thank you so much for your generous words, Robert, and deeply moved and appreciated of your friendship and your support and all the insight that you have gifted all of us here today. So thanks so much for coming.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.